I'm excited because that's one of the questions that I do want to ask or talk about today when we're talking about authorial intent, which is, you know, sort of the layers of it, including, you know, is it more difficult to get at authorial intent if it's not your native language? So that could be an interesting little, I am such a dork. God, these words Mitch. Coming out of my mouth.
I didn't want to say anything and be rude, but yeah.
Greetings, Savory Inferiors, and welcome to Vampire Insider, the unofficial podcast of the Anne Rice Immortal Universe. Each week, co-hosts Christina LaRusso, Joanne Palumbo, and myself, Mark Snedeker, recap and analyze episodes, delve into Anne Rice's library, and have in-depth discussions of other works about the supernatural. Joining us today is at Inky Blot Posts, a longtime Anne Rice fan and member of the very active Twitter fandom community. Inky Blot, also known as Joe, whose background is in literature, has had a profound connection with Rice's source material from a young age. She and a friend ran an active Facebook forum dedicated to discussion of the Vampire Chronicles, and she even communicated directly with Anne prior to her death about what a Lestat and Louis wedding might be like. Joe is a show super fan who has met several of the actors, including Asad Zaman and Sam Reed in Paris, and Joseph Potter, who will be playing Nikki in season 2. We are so grateful that she agreed to join us on today's episode, in which we are going to be discussing authorial intent and the reading and viewing experience. So I'd like to welcome my fellow podcasters, Christina LaRusso, Joanne Palumbo, and of course, our special guest, Inky Blot Posts.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, guys. How's it going? We have a special guest today, Inky Blot Posts, a.k.a. Joe. Joe, how are you? Why don't you tell our listeners a little something about yourself?
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me. I live in England, as you can probably tell from my accent. I've been a fan of Anne Rice for over 20 years, and I have a degree from university in English and related literature.
What would be related literature, like Scottish literature, maybe?
Actually, French. French translation.
So related in the sense of being at odds with one another and constantly wanting to murder the other literature.
Well, it's certainly interesting. I'll say that.
So, Joe, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, who is your favorite interview with the vampire character and why?
I mean, I could go for philosophical and like pull one of the slightly more interesting characters, but I'm just going to have to say it. It's Lestat. I love an anti-hero. And since I was 13, 14 years old, Lestat has been my anti-hero. You know, he's been the bravery when I didn't feel brave. He's been the light when I felt dark. He's been the doer when I felt paralyzed, you know, and I love the character because of his complexity, because he's not just all good or all bad. You know, he's a very intriguing character. And I think you can study a character and live with a character and read about a character for 20 years and still not feel like you completely know them. And that is what keeps drawing me back to him. And I think in terms of what Anne has crafted, not only has she crafted a hero for the stories, an antagonist, a complicated character, and, you know, a metaphor, obviously, as a vampire for quite a lot of what we go through as humans, but there's something about Lestat which also draws the other characters to him. And I guess it could only be described as his soul. There's something very immense about who he is, like his personality, his endurance, his indomitability. But, you know, Nicholas says, you know, there's a light in you. You seem to shine, and I don't know what it is. And it pisses me off because I'm all darkness. But there is something about Lestat that he's too big. You know, I mean, one of my favorite quotes, it's actually David in Tale of the Body Thief says this. It's when Lestat is inviting him to have sex with him when he's human. And David says no. And Lestat's like, oh, you know, he doesn't want me because he can sense that I'm evil. Even in this body, he still knows that I'm me and I'm evil. And David turns to him and he says, no, you're not evil. That's not it. It's me. Don't you understand? It's my fear. You don't know what this adventure has meant to me, to be here again in this part of the great world and with you. I love you. I love you desperately and insanely. I love the soul inside you. And don't you see? It's not evil. It's not greedy. But it is immense. It overpowers even this youthful body because it's your soul, fierce and indomitable and outside time, the soul of the true Lestat. I can't give in to it. I can't do it. I'll lose myself forever if I do. She's just made him imminently likable by everyone, even though he's a terrible person.
But I mean, see, that's it. He's a great vampire. And yeah, he's, if you would put him, base him on human mores, he's a bad guy. He's a terrible guy, but he's a great vampire. And I think that we have to allow, I see a lot of hand-wringing where people are either uncomfortable that others like Lestat, or even people who love Lestat are at now a point where they feel that they have to justify loving Lestat for some reason. And I just think to myself, he's an anti-hero. He's a bad guy. We are allowed to love them. Look, I don't understand where the stumbling block to either understanding that you can like something fictional that's dark and still be a good person in your real life.
Even though you probably aren't.
But it's interesting, I find, because I think that it's not dissimilar to what Louis goes through. In the trailer, originally, there was a line which didn't make it into the show, and it was Lestat saying to Louis, "You don't fear me, Louis, you fear yourself." And I think a lot of the struggle that Louis goes through accepting that he loves Lestat, which, you know, I don't think he has quite even accepted it by this point in the show yet. At least he hasn't said it. But he struggles with that because what does that mean about him? And I think going to Europe and going to Paris, you know, he may be forced to come to terms with sides of his character that he was running away from. And I don't think that he was so much running away from the dark sides of Lestat. He was running away from the fact that he liked it, or that he was even maybe capable of similar.
Do we think these people were morally outraged by the shark in Jaws? Like, that guy, he was just so inconsiderate and rude.
I mean, more apt. I get the joke there, but more.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. What a relief.
More apt, I think, is to well, like Tony Soprano, or sure, as a more current thing, like Hannibal. And this is that Walter White or whatever.
Look, historically, everybody always loves a bad guy. Right. I mean, I don't get why people get so worked up over this.
Because people love getting worked up.
It's not real. You know, it's not like you're sitting here going, oh, I hope people aren't going like, oh, I admire Scott Peterson, the guy who killed his pregnant wife on Christmas Eve. That would be a little disturbing to hear. But to hear that you love a fictional character that does what vampires do, or whatever type of character, and people get so worked up about it, it just blows my mind.
And that it's actually a very healthy thing for us to explore these darker issues through fiction and entertainment. And that's one of the reasons it exists, right? It allows us to kind of step back from the reality of our daily lives and consider these other things. And, you know, and a horrible person can be attractive and interesting. It's just that you don't want to admire them necessarily for, you know, and like want to emulate their horribleness.
Perhaps another way to look at it as well is that the complexity of these characters means that they are neither a good guy or a bad guy in the simplistic way. You know, quite a lot of people can relate to that feeling of internal struggle. You know, I think this idea of a gray area, you know, good people are capable of monstrous things and monstrous people are capable of good things. And I think the fact that it's not so simplistic as these are the bad guys, these are the good guys, you know, that's what makes these characters so compelling.
I agree.
You know, I want to challenge you, Christina, about one thing you said about how Mark's comparison about Jaws, that's actually a better comparison, I think, than a Walter White or somebody, because vampires aren't human beings. They're animals.
Well, they're monsters. Yeah.
Right. They're monsters. So that would, you know, I think that's a better parallel than a Walter White, just because the vampire looks human and walks and talks and does, you know, human type things. They're, at the end of the day, they're really not.
Well, and this is actually a nice segue into our discussion on authorial intent, because as we know, vampire as a literary device, vampire can mean something else. And historically in fiction, vampire has often been used as a kind of a code for sex or sexual activity. That goes directly to the subject of our talk today, which is authorial intent. We've got fan fiction back, and Joe is going to first read a little segment from a fanfic. So, Joe, you selected this fanfic. Can you tell us a little bit about it, who the author is, and then read the selection?
Absolutely. This is a fanfiction called Black Soft Unearthly by an incredible writer on AO3 called Poet to Nun. I absolutely adore their way of writing, particularly in this piece, because, again, talking about authors and writing, it's a very unusual piece because it tells the story of Lestat's turning that night when he was turned by Magnus, but it's from Magnus's point of view. So it's a very interesting point of view because, you know, you're seeing the story happening, but through the lens of madness. So yeah, it's a fascinating piece and very beautifully written, in my opinion.
Great. Well, we are excited to hear it.
Just a bit of a content warning because it is the story of Lestat's turning, the night he was abducted. So it's kind of an assault. I choose ingredients. I measure their worth. It's a distinct way of thinking. I drain the bottles of experiments as easy as I perceive they are insufficient. I'm already thinking of a new element, an untested substance. I lapse on the word for it sometimes, but never the feeling of it. The feeling of such a thing's too real to lose. That's what it is about him. The wolves. The feeling to him. Cold. Blood. Triumph, change. It's his, but it's mine, as one. I don't know what element that will do. Similar we are, and dissimilar to all, almost. I want him. I want the wolf killer. It will be him, the wolf killer. Come to me now. Wolf killer's body lifts itself with my demand, though I don't mean for it to. His mind still half in dreaming from the look on his expression. His one hip hangs lower, thick knee forward, garments untucked, untied, unfolding in ripples. All of him unfolds to a trance-like stand. His chin's level to my collarbone. My feet stir, tentative but calm. I cross tenebrous steps. He becomes alert, concerned. One glance flashes to each necessary point as hunter's eyes do, then to me. Wolf killer. Amusement flickers within as I realize. He's recognizing me in the dark. How? To him I look headless, a night mist with a man's body. I don't let a single thought hide from me. Muskets, no help to you. A sword, no help to you either. The speed of my eye pauses on Wolfkiller's red cloak. My arm stretches and shimmering velvet is in my hand. No mess, shall we then? I move again, normal in time, a few steps, heavy. I thrust the cloak. I leap. My hands grab the whole of his weight where they grip. It matters little where, bone, muscle, or fat, he's mine. Through the pane with glittering shards we fly, they're still coated in fractal lace. Shards slide from the velvet I wrap him with into murky alleys below. I leave dotted prints between my soaring until it's harder to focus. His wild movements against me, kicking, such spirit, I could adore it. What if you dropped, wolf killer? Lick you in a reddish puddle, what's left of you, soured by the street waste. I want to laugh again. I release that I can with one arm catch and the other climb. Two quicker hops and I fling him roughly. His loose, lean body skids through the powdery, bright cresting of the roof. He swings half his body round in one of his twists, and suddenly the annoyance unbalances my patience altogether. His face contorts when his bare hands sink in snow, the cloak unfolded, an enormous breath expanding his chest when in shock at his surroundings. But he runs. Runs. To where? The roof edges? I laugh. It's coming out of my oft unused voice, already low, low rasping. How dreadful my mirth is to him. I'm old. I feel no apology. Laughter itself feels good.
Damn you! He shouts. A rage begins, upwards from his stance to the broad shoulders. Who the hell are you? Gusts splinter his thick, pale hair. How naked his aspect is. His numbed white fists now tremble and clench. There's a primal enticement to feel them. Each brutal thud echoes in ribs that protect nothing, reverberates into long feet that are firm. They end as they start his blows. But heat, like tracing flames, I feel that. I want that. Snow packs itself under his feet each swing. It makes him slip. Wind grips my cape, all the clothes on my body like thin weeds in how much they move. And my wolf killer sends himself up, bruising their dance with these blows. Not bruising me. He can't. Wolf killer, you seem my angry child. You pierce my composure. I laugh. I laugh. I think there's more than a laugh in my voice. For a moment, the black center of his eyes grows too round, realizing. What do you want with me? He demands. Who are you? I think of ice that doesn't crack over my answers. Oh, eager the feeling of him being engulfed by them as freezing depths. I'm your cold lover. I'm your death. I want to stop laughing. I'm everlasting. I'm mad. I want to seduce you with myself. How funny it is. Pointless. He sharpens suddenly into a blur of branching fingers, a blur of misted breath, all blurred. My black hair unravels from my hood, a heavy cave of darkness that shrouds my chest like I stand a mountain. I shove his hips at the bone. His breath leaves him sharply. I speed myself enough. He misses crucial transitions. Each graceful intent I offer, experienced in one brief touch. One way, another way, I tilt, a spiral of soft black catching once, twice between his fingers as he does what he still can to strike. Not one strike to me, not now. I read across his mind, confusion at what I do, embarrassment. He wants to believe I mean mockery. He blinks at a web of black hair. He holds the tethers back to me. Brave, strong, my little wolf killer, I whisper. Rounder, deeper, a scoff at my own effort and his. I think the lines of my face soften to be fond, and my wry smile becomes affectionate. That arm trembles, fingers curling open, knees weakening. Oh God, help me, help me! Like the moon surrenders when eclipsed by clouds, fear enters my wolf killer. Fear too looming and too wicked. God! What God? I lilt in insincere curiosity. What God is there for you, wolf killer? He pivots and, no, I am beyond this. I clamp each shoulder and spin him around. I drop him, my cloak a great circle hovering over us. The air rushes from its collapse. I pin him deep in the bones of his chest. No struggle. The wild yearning to struggle, that's all my wolf killer feels now. Under the black dome, no eye to see. I hold the cry of thirst in my throat, stroke my lip to his neck gently, like a breath if I still did breathe. My wolf killer's skin pierces, ripe, heat flushed, salted. My body lays deeper on him, and our limbs spread and spread in untouched snow, my neck twisting his flesh in my teeth as blood and sighing mingle. The mouthfuls he gives. My hand expands over his pounding heart. Vampire! There's his mind's voice. An endless reservoir of inspirations and rebellions. It can hold such delicate forms. I'll never know them all. Yes, wolf killer. No more I drink. My fangs slip out, wet, dripping luscious vermilion, and my long knotted fingers rub back and forth on the pricks without yielding pressure. Lelio. I breathe. It's only a whisper. The wolf killer. My wolf killer. Must be saved. Don't. I press curled toes deep to the bare roof. Stand in a long stretch as one about to sprint, and my wolf killer's ribs heave rapidly on my chest, on my shoulders. He shakes so in pain, and his sobs choke a sweet voice I love in an instant. I twist the velvet fur cape around my wrist, then spring, carrying him into the pool of stars. End of chapter one.
That was very good.
First of all, you're very, very talented at reading.
You've been doing it for years, right?
I tell you, it's just the British accent. That's all it is.
You evoke the mood very, very well. Whatever the mood is, you're setting it very well with your reading. And it's just, it's such a pleasure to hear great fan fiction read in a powerful way. So thank you very much for doing that.
That was my pleasure. Thank you for letting me read.
I feel like Poet to Nun has probably written something before. Like, this isn't their first go, right?
I can't imagine.
No, I mean, that was extremely well written. It's a very interesting perspective shift. Yeah. And just, I mean, beautifully evocative, great flow to the text. I mean, it's just very, very, very well done.
And not a single preternatural.
No, they didn't say preternatural at all. I would have snuck it in. Probably I would have gone, oh, my preternatural Lelio.
Yeah, I'm excited to read the next chapter of it. Joe, is there any way that you could read me the next chapter?
I can probably record it and send it to you. Thing is, it does get quite NSFW.
Oh, boy.
It's a very interesting point of view to have Magnus's point of view of that whole thing. Yes, there's madness there. And it's really interesting how Poet to Nun has, in the very beginning, one of the first paragraphs, talks, Magnus is talking about how he used to be an alchemist and thinking of ingredients. And he's talking about the stat as if he's a new ingredient that he's never tried before.
Because he knows he's mad, right? I mean, he has the sense that he is in his madness.
Yes. And I think there's also this element. I mean, I got the element from the story that he's so far beyond humanity now. He's almost, yes, he's mad, but that madness has also disassociated him. He's almost kind of behind a mirror, behind a glass. He's just sort of apart from everything. Even as Lestat is beating his fists upon him and trying, like, literally fighting for his life, it almost feels like he can't feel any of it. He can't connect with it. It's just fascinating.
And I think a great illustration of his removal from humanity is when he laughs, right? His unused voice. Because, of course, he's not interacting with anyone other than victims. There's no need for him to speak. He's not conversing with the humans around him.
Yeah.
And that's a great illustration about showing his isolation.
Very interesting comparison also to Magnus and Lestat. I mean, I'm talking about book Magnus here as well, which Poet to Nun has picked up on, is the laughter at inappropriate moments. Both of them seem to have a propensity for that. I think Lestat more than anyone. But it's quite interesting that Magnus is also someone who laughs at the wrong moment.
I'm going to shift away from the fanfic for just one second and highlight your point about laughing at inappropriate moments. And I was thinking about that as you were saying it, and I'm kind of thinking it through. And the showrunners, the writers, did a really good job of that with show Lestat.
Yes.
Because they didn't overuse it. It would have become ridiculous and absurd if they had constantly had him cackling at inappropriate moments. They chose, and maybe it's down to editing. You know, we don't necessarily know, or maybe it's down just to Sam's choice, right, as an actor in that moment. But to have just that, really that one moment where Sam is laughing inappropriately when Louis talks to him about Antoinette and his feelings about Lestat engaging with Antoinette. And, you know, I mean, Lestat laughs. If they had overused that, he would have become ridiculous as a character.
Do you know why you like it? Because you are the queen of intrusive thoughts.
I am the queen of intrusive thoughts.
She'll be just looking at me. She's like, I wonder what happened if I just smashed you right in the face. I'm like, well, please.
Wow, Christina. Wow.
Speaking of Lestat laughing, I completely agree with you. And I think that there are a couple of moments for quite a lot of us book fans where it was like, there he is. And the first one for me, interestingly, was in the first episode. No, sorry, the second episode, when Louis runs out just before he gets burned by the sun and douses himself in milk. But he shoves Lestat against the wall and then slams the door behind him. And unusually, this is one of the only times you get to see Lestat not from Louis's point of view. And I don't know how that works narratively, but the camera zooms in on Lestat and he, for once, doesn't have a
performance going on, he just quietly says to himself, "You're going to find that very difficult." And he looks pensive, and he looks like he's not wearing a mask for once. And that, for me, I was like, oh my God, they're here. And then the second moment, of course, was the laughing. It was like, yes.
And just the way that Sam did it, just his physicality, Sam's physicality is so, so tremendous as Lestat. All right, quickly back to the fan fiction, though. I agree with what sort of Mark's assessment and saying that the author is so evocative and the language choice is so beautiful.
That's not the kind of language that they use in other stories. It's very particular to Magnus's narrative voice. And I think, you know, that's what struck me was just the skill with which they wielded language to convey a perspective, you know, and one that's a warped perspective. And in fact, the language really reminded me of like Gerard Manley Hopkins, like the Wind Hover, "I caught this morning, morning's minion, kingdom of daylight still found, dapple dawn-drawn falcon in his riding." You know, that kind of almost musical cadences and playfulness with words.
100% agree. And it's a pleasure to listen to. And I cannot wait to read the rest of it. And I'm just, I loved it. It was a great choice and a nice way to launch us back into fan fiction reading on the podcast.
Shout out to Poet to Nun. Thank you so much for sharing your work.
Let's jump into this subject matter. So just as a way to bring everybody onto the same page. A basic definition of authorial intent is that it refers to an author's intent as it is encoded in their work. Authorial intentionalism is the view that an author's intentions should constrain the ways in which a text is properly interpreted. So, Joe, as a lit student, is there anything that you would like to add to that definition?
As a scholar of literature, trying to interpret authorial intent, it gets quite sort of inception because you end up inferring things and guessing things that the author maybe intended. But again, it's you putting those layers onto the text. And especially when the author's no longer alive to answer direct questions or things like that, you know, when you're studying older texts, authorial intent, I think when it's layered on or guessed at or inferred by a scholar is as much a reflection of the scholar as it is of the author. I mean, that's kind of a little bit what Daniel is saying about once you put it out there, they decide what it is when he's saying to Louis. But I love the fact that the show has played with that. They've played with this idea of narratives and intent because it's a double framing. You've got Anne Rice's book that's then been framed as a show, and then the show has got Louis's story that he's telling as another narrator. So when we talk about authorial intent, are we talking about Louis as the author or Anne as the author? And of course, that can be applicable to the book as well. So yeah, it's a complete jumble in my head right now.
I agree. I think let's start with Anne as the author. What I wanted to sort of start with, though, is the question of, is authorial intent, how important is it or should it be as we approach a text? And in this case, we're talking about the original source material, but we can also call the series a text. So we may be talking about both kind of intertwined.
So first, I think I've mentioned this in other podcasts possibly, but I'm not a big authorial intent guy. I think it's interesting, but in the definition that you read where it said that the interpretation of the text should be limited by authorial intent, I believe that is, and I think the academic term for that is horseshit. That is absolutely, absolutely not true. You should not say, well, this subtext here can't possibly be there because we don't think the author wanted it to be. As Shakespeare said, the play's the thing, the book's the thing, the movie's the thing. They should be, if it's well done, able to stand alone. Because of course, you know, the author may be writing things or performing, you know, the performance may include things that they don't personally believe. They, you know, the guy who wrote Breaking Bad wasn't necessarily pro-meth, right? I mean, it was just, you know, and whether their intent is a morality play or not, if it isn't in the text, it isn't there. And I know that there are people who do believe that authorial intent is important. And I think it's interesting sometimes, right? It's interesting to go to talk to Anne Rice and say, hey, what were you intending here? Blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, the text has to provide the answers. I'm a sola scriptura kind of guy.
That interests me because I was just thinking, as I mean, I agree with you to a certain extent about the fact is it's not in the book, it's not there. But I was just thinking about how different the series would be had they just taken the book without any knowledge of Anne and maybe even the rest of her oeuvre. And I mean, the great thing about Anne is that she did answer so many questions and fleshed out these characters for people who wanted to know things about them. So if they had not taken her intent into account as respectfully and voraciously as they did, how different the show would be if they had just word for word interpreted the first book on a surface level as what it is, you know?
You know, I rarely ever do this, but I have to 100% agree with Mark. When you publish something out into the world, as Daniel pointed out of the episodes, it's now theirs to do with what they want. And I strongly believe that. And I think in a situation where creating it for the masses, like AMC is doing, then yeah, you maybe have to pay a little more attention to the authorial intent. But even at that point, you don't have to stick with it. But you do need to still follow the source material close enough so that you're not losing the core fans of what it is all about. But at the end of the day, I don't think it matters because it's really what, you know, what you take away. You could listen to a song. We could each listen to the same song and each one of us could feel a certain way and interpret it a completely different way. And I think that's what is beautiful about media and art, and whether it's written or it's a song or a television show, whatever, it does become your own. And I think a lot of people, especially in this fandom, have made Interview with the Vampire, the Anne Rice, you know, the whole series, what they needed it to be at that particular moment. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
That's a good point.
Now, I do think, and here I'm not going to argue against myself a little bit, I do think you can explore authorial intent in order to help you interpret and analyze a piece, if, you know, especially something that's very dense and, you know, you're struggling to get through it. If the author says, what I meant here, you know, when I invoked the name of Ozymandias or whatever it is, was, you know, hearkening back to, you know, Mighty Kings of Old or something like that. And you're like, oh, and then you go back to the text though and check and see if that is borne out by the text, because ultimately that is the test.
Well, it's interesting that you brought up Shakespeare because, Mark, when you quoted Shakespeare, because to me, there is so much that's actually, what scholars suggest, encoded, particularly in my case, historians. When you approach Shakespeare's work, we don't necessarily as a historian approach it as literature, although we recognize that it is. We approach it as what's he really trying to say about his world around him. So for me as a historian, authorial intent, because I'm approaching it as a historian,
right,
is very important there. I don't even have to like Shakespeare's work to get something out of it at approaching it as a historian. Approaching it as a playgoer, so somebody who's going to the theater to see it performed, I'm going to have a very different experience. So it's interesting, not only is there maybe a number of ways that authors approach, well, certainly this is, I think this is just going to be repeating what Joanne said. Not only is there different ways that an author might mean for the work to be understood, there are different lenses through which you can view a text and have yourself multiple experiences. So reading Richard III as a historian will be necessarily different than me watching it as a play. As a play.
I have a question for Joe. Joe, would you distinguish between authorial intent and like historical context, right? Because if you're reading Shakespeare and you don't know what he means when he calls something a nunnery, right, you're going to miss the point. But do you think that is wrapped up in authorial intent?
I would say that they are separate, but they could be linked because I'd imagine that authorial intent is the personal intention of the author as they're writing, their thoughts, their dreams, their hopes, their intention for what they want this piece of art that they're creating to be and how they want it to be perceived.
And I think that that can be quite strongly in certain circumstances influenced by context. So in some ways they are, you know, very related, because an author's time, their upbringing, their everything about who they are when they're living, that can influence what they're wanting to create.
Do you think that an author always understands his or her intent? Or do you think that sometimes, based on just exactly what you're talking about, their context, that what they're writing is that they don't have maybe the intent that then upon further review and with the distance of time, and I might see, and other historians might see, okay, Shakespeare's doing very specific critique of Tudor politics, but did Shakespeare sit down to write it? You know, there's a lot of guesswork there, particularly in Joe, you mentioned this. If the author is dead, you can't interrogate the author about what their intention was.
I would say that maybe that is even applicable to Interview with the Vampire, in terms of Anne Rice not quite having a fully formed clarity about her intent as she was writing. And of course, not even knowing that what it would go on to become, and the intention she had in that book for certain characters then changed, you know, as we know. But I think Interview with the Vampire as a standalone novel, the intention was for it to be a standalone. I think she was, as we all know, you know, it was a vessel for her grief. Louis was a vessel for her grief, a form of expression. And I don't know if she had, I mean, it would be fascinating to ask her this. I wish she was still alive. I don't know if she had an intent other than expressing it, putting it somewhere, finding words for it, in terms of knowing exactly how she wanted the audience to receive it, or exactly what she wanted it to be or appear or start as a vampire novel, in terms of, you know, what it ended up going on to be.
That's a good segue and kind of into this, the other part of what I wanted to talk about here with respect to authorial intent. And that is, Anne may have written, as you're pointing out, Interview with the Vampire. We all know the lore of that is that she wrote a short story, and then upon Michelle getting sick and dying, she picked that short story back up, and that short story became Interview with the Vampire, which, again, as you mentioned, was meant to be a standalone novel, but then became something much, much bigger, right? And it could be, you know, the first novel, if you sit down and read that novel, is clearly to me about grief and grieving. It's very clear that that is a big portion of what is going on in that novel. Now, initially reading the novel, I didn't have that background information. I just picked it up and read the book. But it still seems to me that it was very clear to me that it was about existential crisis, right? And grief is a great catalyst for existential crisis. I'm wondering if then, in the years between, she realized, okay, I have more to say about this. And that's, as she's writing, clarifying for her purpose in writing these books. So, for instance, Interview with the Vampire is often seen by people as a kind of fluid sexuality coded, but subtextually. Did she mean that going in, or is that what it ends up being? Because she has said that vampires are the perfect metaphor for the outsider who is in the midst of everything, yet completely cut off, which would seem in that time frame, in the 70s and 80s, to be, would resonate with people who may have been closeted sexually because of the social mores of the time.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Are you familiar with the phrase authorial intrusion?
Is that when Anne slides into your email box and threatens litigation?
Yes, that's exactly. No, when the author decides to tell you what they think about a situation outside of a character's voice.
She was very good at that.
Yeah, but I'm not a huge fan of that, because really the story should unfold from the characters and the situation.
So are you saying the narrative voice tells you is heavy?
Yeah,
is
exactly.
Ham-handed?
It's basically
okay,
the narrative.
Because
yeah.
what
it doesn't
Joe
have to be ham-handed. It can be well done, right? But that's authorial intrusion, is when the author's sticking in and saying, this is what's up.
Okay, right? So there's that happens within the text, but then there's also that which right, happens afterwards. When the author comes at you in a book review section.
You don't know shit from Shinola.
You are interpreting this from in the wrong direction, or what did she say? It's a famous thing that Anne Rice
It was something like that.
Anne Rice did.
So I do think that even though I'm all about, you know, the text is the thing, and that's really where you should find the meaning, that doesn't mean necessarily that I think all interpretations are valid. Mm-hmm. I think that you still have to have some rein on what kind of meaning. Now, you can do whatever you want, right? But if you expect to be taken seriously, you can't say, oh, I think Romeo and Juliet was a retelling of the Genesis story or something like that.
Which may, I can just
honestly, I'm sure somebody has written a paper on that somewhere. But you can't just say, oh, it means this because I think it does, right? You really should have it based in the text somehow.
See, and to me, that's what text is the thing is about, is that you have to have the proof. You have to be able to make some kind of an argument based on text. I can't just come at it and go, well, I just think this. So you guys, come on, get on board.
I mean, I'm always rabbiting on about how I think that the show, and the first book, but the show's really picked up on this, is about perspectives and obviously narrative perspectives and the interview and Louis and his selective memory. But it's also, I was wondering as you were speaking, how much perhaps is the show also about interpretations? Because again, it's not just Louis writing, it's Louis telling his story to Daniel, who's interpreting it live before our eyes. What immediately came to my mind was, how are they going to deal with and weave in the change of Claudia with Delaney as the new Claudia? And in my opinion, it would be great if they did something as simple as have Louis show Daniel a picture of Claudia, which he took with his little camera in the 1940s. And Daniel could just say something like, oh, I imagined her slightly different.
That would be a beautiful way of doing
it. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
But that would explain the change, because again, it's about interpretation. And so season one, Claudia was Daniel's interpretation of Claudia.
I would love it.
How would you have them?
I think they're going to treat it the same way as when they switched Mrs. Fresh Prince, right? In the Fresh Prince, where they switched moms. Yeah. So when they switched moms in the Fresh Prince, nobody said a thing about it.
I see what you're saying, but I think this show in particular is quite unique in the fact that it has this opportunity to play with perspectives and change of, I mean, the whole show is about distortion of memory.
Well, maybe they can do something where have Lestat make some sort of funny, like, oh, you look different on this continent or something, you know, silly like that.
I would love to see him do a big dramatic double take.
Oh my God. You guys know I'm with Joe. It needs to be subtle. And I bet you, Joe, if those writers, they probably racked their brains for ways to deal with it. And your solution is extremely elegant. And that is, I will accept nothing better than nothing other than that great solution. So writers, we know now that you're listening.
That's right. I know you guys are plugged in pretty much directly.
That's right. I agree with you, Joe, and I would say that perspective definitely comes into play. Daniel obviously is a stand-in for the audience. At least I see
for
it
now.
That way. For now. I think he's going to become more
a part
of it.
The Greek chorus is going to get sucked into the story, though. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, but we also have to take into consideration the viewpoint of the viewers, the actual viewers. And most of our listeners, Joe, you may not know this, actually don't exist on Twitter or don't seem to exist on Twitter. A lot of them do, but not all of them. We have a bigger audience than what we engage with on Twitter. When you do engage on Twitter, you see how multiple points of view are really in play. We can all watch the same show and come away with it with very different interpretations of what's going on in the scene. That look at everybody's sort of got different ideas and headcanon about what's coming in season two. That's a good example of it. You know, based on, we all watched the same show, but most of us have all these widely divergent ideas of, well, what's going to happen in season two. And I think that's why it's worthwhile to keep, for us on the podcast, to keep coming back to discussions about what's going on what do we think is coming on season two? Because it can change. It can change with, I might read something on Twitter and my interpretation of it changes. So yeah, I definitely do agree that there is a lot to do with perspective in this. And what does that look like?
In my opinion, it's been one of the things that the show has done absolutely masterfully. The idea of taking what is essentially a 50-year-old story and being able to tell it in a way that is still so fresh and exciting that you have people discussing it for hours and huge essay threads and discourse on Tumblr. And honestly, it's incredible how they've managed to make something that is both true to the beloved story that book readers know and love, is engaging for non-book readers, but also fresh and new and so compelling.
I have 2.5 hours of really good conversation, so I want to turn this into a two-part episode. So let's wrap this up here. Joe, do you have any social media that you would like to share with our listeners where they can find you and interact if they would like to?
I am Inky Block Posts on Twitter and Tumblr. I'd love to hear if anyone wants to message me. I love having chats about the show.
I would like to thank you for following us each week. And if you like us, come and follow us on Twitter. I am at Christina Gen X. We have a page at Vampire_Insider. And you can find Mark at Mark Eats Peach. Thanks and bye.
Peace out, Cub Scouts.